I wonder if the reason time is eternal is because God keeps falling asleep and having to start over again. I mean, he got 15 billion years. I made it 15 billion years this time. I really have to pay more attention. Okay. So, let's see. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to have a discussion of the virtues that go with each element. These were first described to the elements in the Bai Hu Dong, discussions from the White Tiger Hall, which in my understanding probably something happened like the emperor sent the army to go get all these Confucian scholars and put them in a room and said, you can't leave till you have a book. Something like, you know, Chuang Tzu tells these stories about how the officials come out and want to bring him back to the court, and he points to a turtle dragging his mud in the tail and says, I'd rather be like the turtle. And so this was, I think, the first top-down perspective on Confucianism, which means, I think, what was this, 200 AD, Heiner?
I think it was a little, it was like 50 BC.
50 BC?
Mm-hmm.
So it's still several hundred
years. 50 AD.
Yeah, I thought it was AD. So the point is it's still 400 years or so after Confucius, and the emperor assembles the scholars and says, I want you to give a statement and synthesize the Confucian literature. And you can buy the Bai Hu Dong translated into English. It's in two volumes. The second volume is in print. The first volume you can, if you Google it, you can actually download. It's the same phonetics as the herb formula Bai Hu Tong, White Tiger, but instead of soup, White Tiger Hall. The Tong is a different character. Discussions from the White Tiger Hall. And in this, one of the things they do is they pair the Confucian virtues with the five elements. Now, that's historically notable because as soon as you do that, you've tied the entire philosophical context of the culture into medicine and cosmology. Do you understand? So they said that that wisdom goes with water. And benevolence, or humility, as I call it, goes with wood. Propriety goes with fire. Integrity and reciprocity go with earth. And righteousness goes with metal. And the person who introduced me to that was Ted Kapchuk in the late 80s when I took his herb class with him. He was basically, by that time, teaching mostly five-element herbs, which was causing quite a stir because the people he had originally been in with, you know, he wrote The Web That Has No Weaver, and he had this end note where he kind of laughed at the five elements and how naive they were, and was in with the straight TCM folk, and then had somewhat of a religious awakening to the to the distinction between the materialism and TCM and the five elements. So he rewrote The Web That Has No Weaver, completely changing the orientation of that footnote. And by the time I was studying, and what happened was he started teaching, and some of the students just a couple years ahead of me from TAI went to take his first herb course. I think I was in the second time he taught it. And then through interaction with us, he really woke up to the five-element tradition and got what Worsley was doing. And by the time I studied with him, it was pretty much really 70% toward five element that he was teaching. And he mentioned the Bai Hu Dong just as a footnote to in the introduction to the course. And then I followed up on that and put it together. But he gets the credit for the introduction. So would you like to?
Yeah, the names, how they appear then later from that time on in the literature, they call the Wu Chang, the five constants. That's the same Chang as in the first sentence of the Tao Te Ching, the Dao Ke Dao, Fei Chang Dao Ye. The Tao that can be expressed in words is not the eternal Tao, so that external constant, that's Chang. And then it's called the Wude, the five virtues. That's where the English word comes from. And but remember that the, in the deeper sense of the word, is has to do with action. Okay, so it's really the deeper meaning of the term Wuxing, which means the five modes of operation, the five modes of being in the world through action, every moment. With everything you do, say, or think, or mostly do. De is that earth quality that has to do with transformation and making it shizai from a Chinese perspective, and it means solid. It accomplishes something. It's not just an abstract concept. And then finally, wuxing, same pinyin, but different from the second tone, wuxing, the five phases. This wuxing is fourth tone, and is that character that Lonnie referred to on the first day, which is the heart radical on the left. That can also be, when it's underneath, it looks like that, like an actual heart, and then this is, when you squeeze it on the left, it's abbreviated like this. And then you've got life or growth or creation on the right. So born from the heart means our true nature. That's the same true nature that the true nature radio is named after, and that that's really what Confucianism is the belief that there is, all of the universe is filled with positive energy, and human beings are by nature good, and that it's our true nature not to be depressed and have negative thoughts, but that, you know, if you just, the negative emotions and thoughts are like phlegm and stagnating blood. You just gotta move them through, and then the true nature, the jing and the qi and the shen, will shine forth. So those are all three different names for the so-called five virtues.
Yeah, and I'd have a few things to say. If we look at the first one, again, this means original nature in the infant and virtue in the adult. And we just always want to be clear to distinguish the two. What the original nature in the infant is the simplicity before complexity. And then when you return to the source, then you cultivate, and you cultivate virtue. And virtue is the simplicity after complexity. So there are all these allusions in the Tao Te Ching to I alone suckle at the mother's breast, which is a metaphor for returning to infancy. Or I am like a child. And they talk, the Tao Te Ching says, the infant can cry all day without getting hoarse. Fierce beasts will not attack it. Wasps will not sting it. Such is the perfection of its jing. Such is the fullness of its jing. So the child's jing is full. But the sage transformed that jing into marrow, and it rises up the spine, and there's awakening. And then when you see the Taoist sages, you see this huge head, which stands for transforming marrow into bone. But the deeper thing is to make room for the bigger brain, which is itself an outer metaphor for having transformed the base potential into wisdom. So we want to just keep in mind that original nature is the domain of the infant, and virtue is the domain of the sage. Original nature we're born with, virtue is something we cultivate. In terms of calling them the five constants, that character constant, we could almost translate into English as the absolute. So the absolute is that which does not change. So we have the absolute and the relative. We have the Sheng cycle. We have all these transformations, winter, spring, late summer, winter, spring, summer, late summer, fall, fear, anger, joy and sorrow, worry and grief, just moving like weather. And the illusion of the ego is that where we exist is exclusively out in that transformation, being stirred by the Big Dipper, swept along by the currents. And the whole practice of cultivation is to remove oneself from the circle so one becomes the center point, that single point of consciousness that never changes. And then you can see the five elements spinning around you, but you are free of that movement. You're a master of your own destiny. And when you see pictures of Taoists meditating, you see them like this, with the North Star above and the Big Dipper. And the alchemical text says that in cultivation, the point is to turn around the Big Dipper. That rather than being stirred through life by it, you now reverse the entire cycle intentionally. And this has a lot to do with the characters Shun and Ni. So Shun is a picture of a person swimming in the direction of the stream.
That's that Chuan we had with the triple warmer yesterday with a head. So the head goes in the direction of the stream, Shun. And the knee we had with the liver, remember that was the upside down person, is the old version of that. And here it's more a picture of a blade of grass that pushes against the surface and is about to bust out.
Mm-hmm. So that, so both of these are used in different contexts. On the one hand, when Chibo says that in the days of old people followed the laws of yin and yang, what they're doing is shunning the laws of yin and yang. They're aligning their head with the flow of the river. But the alchemists will say the average person just goes along with life, and then they're shunning it. And by going along, they mean they're just swept along by the current. On the other hand, there are some texts that will use ni, and they'll say people go against the laws of nature, and then what they're doing is they're kneeing, going against it in the sense of eroding their yang and creating yin by not living in harmony with nature. But the other use of ni is to say that people go along this current of being swept around through the karmic circle by extricating themselves and using will and spinning the dipper backwards. So both of these characters can mean ignorance or waking up and going against. They can be used in either context, which is very interesting.
Chapter 1 and 2 of the Neijing are about Shun. You got to go with the flow of nature. Making Shun positive and Ni will destroy you. But from that Taoist cultivation perspective, all cultivation is exact opposite. Like the sitting at night, if you sit for 5 seconds and then your body says, let's go with the flow, I am tired, I want to lay down. So by sitting up, you're actually going against that ego flow. When you stand like that, that's not a natural way of standing. Until later, it will become natural to you, like second nature.
Right. And I suspect that this has something to do with a subtle difference between, it might have even been a political distinction between people with Confucian leanings and Taoist leanings. Because in the Taoist literature, they're used one way, and in those texts with more of a Confucian influence, the other way. So that character Chang for constant means that which does not change. So what does not change? Emptiness does not change. It's eternal. And words can't quite capture it. It's the absolute.
It also means flag, and so it's interesting how these symbols, they go through different traditions and times. Like my Sufi teacher always says, I want you to plant the flag of love and unity and justice, you know. So it's that being in that flow, exposing yourself to that kind of vibration.
Right. And the idea here is that this is a very interesting distinction. What they're saying here, I believe, is that virtue is absolute. In other words, you either have integrity or you don't. If you came to me and you said, you know, I'm thinking of going into business with this fellow, what do you think of his integrity? And I said, yeah, it's pretty good. You'd be like, what? Well, he wants $100,000. Do you think I can trust him, more or less? Right? So there's this sense of virtue being absolute. But what's interesting, what the developmental perspective, the evolutionary perspective of development without end brings, is this duality we have to hold. Virtue is absolute, but you could always have more. In other words, either in any given moment, you either have integrity or you don't. But when you choose integrity in that moment, it engenders more integrity in the next moment. So it's absolute and developing. And if you follow that through to the end, it's actually a statement about the nature of God, which is that God is all, but through our cultivation, God becomes more. God gains self-knowledge through us. You have to look very deeply into that. But virtue would be the manifestation of heaven on earth. And there's this notion that the fully enlightened, whatever that means, it makes no sense to me, but fully enlightened spiritual teacher would be the living embodiment of Dharma and the absolute incarnated into a physical body. So you can clearly see that in Buddhism and in Christianity, Jesus and Buddha are looked at as the absolute, the Son of God on earth, the absolute incarnation into a body. And here the revelation, and so they call it the constant. His virtue is constant, which means it's a manifest, it never wavers, just as when the luminosity and emptiness in meditation never waver. And then the last, in terms of Xing, we have these five constitutions. And that character Xing, the deepest meaning is Buddha nature. So there's only one Buddha nature. But then you have these five constitutions, which are like, again, the facets on a prism. So you can shine a light through a diamond and you see a rainbow on the wall and you see all these different colors that you can name and discern, but you never lose track of the fact that it's just, they're all reflections of one light. And all the named virtues, similarly, wear the prism, and the one light of Buddha nature shines through us, but its manifestation on the world, this person is wood, and this person is earth, and this person is metal, we can name distinctions in that, but we never lose track of the fact that it's one light shining through. Kelly, here you go. I pressed the button. See, what I've been doing is I turn it on, then the person turns it off, and it's not working. That it's absolute and it's developmental. It's both absolute, you have it or you don't in any second, but it's developmental because you could always have more. Well, what's your experience?
Yes. That is my experience.
It's my experience.
My experience.
God said, Abraham, give me a son. Yeah, God, who's going to play sax then? Christ was pretty cool.
What's that?
Jesus and Buddha. The mythic Christ and Buddha.
But it's mythic.
Yeah, but the myth is an archetype, and archetypes are real. And when I go shoot archery, there is an absolute center to that target.
So in the Chinese traditions, also the Yellow Emperor was probably a historical figure, but even if he didn't live, the Yellow Emperor said this or that, somebody wrote it down, doesn't matter where it is, even if the teachings of Jesus are all made up, there was that flow came through a concrete person and is therefore real.
Well, yeah, just let me add on to that. So the thing is that there is this experience that the human being, even though we're relative human beings, we can actually have an experience of the absolute. And there's only one absolute. I mean, every human being's going to experience that same one thing. But then this plays out in different cultures and is talked about depending on the culture it's in and the level of that culture through their own stories and their own creation stories and their own archetypes. So even though a figure like Jesus might have been a synthesis of many, many traditions and that they just depended on this one person regardless of what happens, the point is the archetype, the cosmic Christ, whatever that is, or the omniscient, omnipotent Buddha, that is all just named words for something that actually is so. And so we don't have to get that hung up on historical details. The real teacher is that, and then the I Ching hexagrams and all the Chinese characters and all the postures and everything else we make up is a construct that serves as a vehicle for awakening us to get direct access. So part of my intention in my teaching, and I'm sure in Heiner's, is not so much to remember this, that, and the other thing, but everything is pointing to the student awakening to the same one thing and having the tools and the confidence to become a fit vehicle for it and to have confidence and identify with it so that it starts informing their own creation of their own life and their own work. And the names of, you know, Buddha and Christ, these are just, they are mythic. That's a mythic archetype, but the archetype is real, regardless of what happened. So that's the symbol.
So is this process of continually asking
No, evolution occurs when life asks for more and you give it. And one of my teachers would say you pray all your life for God to show up and then you find out he's a greedy bastard. In other words, people seek their whole lives and when they finally have the revelation, for most people, the experience is a brief period of ecstasy followed by, I am sorry I asked. Because ego wants everything. Ego wants everything. And then you wake up and then you find out God wants everything. And that's what all the myths in the Bible about give me a son and the Iliad, the Odyssey, and all of these myths and all of these stories are just this absolute, you're waking up to a demand which is chong. It's constant. So you say, well, I gave up brownies, and God said, now the green tea. And you say, I gave up the green tea. And then at some point you say, haven't I given enough? And God said, I want your son. You say, but haven't I given enough? That's the ego's position is always, haven't I done enough? Haven't I done enough? And you say, well, look, you're doing this. And you go, but look at everything I did. And apparently, this impulse just keeps pushing and pushing. You liberate it, you give, and it gets to here, but it's a relentless force, and it's never satiated. It's never satiated. And how could it be for the universe to have gone for 15 billion years and still be developing?
That's the the meaning of the word Tao, process. And that's, in a certain way, the Qigong movements we did this morning are a metaphor of our posture in life. Because if we're moving like we do in our modern lives, where everything is linear and goal-oriented, we would be moving like this. Left, right. Left, right. When trying to get to this extreme point, when really the movement, it's all in that transition. It's in the transition. You're not trying to get anywhere. And then in the process of moving, there, when they've done tests in Hungary, if you take a person and you run on the freeway or so and everything is the same, literally your biochemistry starts collapsing. Or you put somebody in a sensory deprivation tank, if you're in the forest path and you move around different, there's always something different. That's what makes life move forward. And in the Wang Feng Yi practices are literally you cooped up in a room for 2 weeks and nobody speaks, so you're able to pressure cook the system, and you have different people to different themes. What's my relationship to my ancestors, to my spouse, to my children, to my integrity, to my wisdom, etc. In the beginning you think, well, I'm not a criminal. I mean, how much could there be? You know, so I fess up. I hit John Smith in college, and I was a little bit rough, in the breakup with my first wife or something. But then I'm really done. I'm different from those other people. But then, as people, it's the groove movement moves forward. People step up and they say things, and you're like, oh my God. That was like just the tip of the iceberg. And you start waking up in the middle of the night on day 11, and you go like, you remember, where you hurt somebody else's heart. That is, the average person would say, you didn't do anything wrong, but it's like your higher nature, as you refine it, that the walking becomes, it's not just I'm not breaking the law, it's about being incredibly careful in my relationship with every person and with the universe itself, and the bar gets set higher. Another translation for the Wuchang is we're saying it means a flag, and in German there's a word that's called Standarte, which means a standard. So a standard is set by this flag that is flying. So it's like these five virtues are like a bar. And every time we think we're getting close to the bar, we have this shining example, the universe does something to raise that bar for you, so you're constantly getting higher. So there's always a dangerous thing. I've seen that in my life. Every time you're getting close to declare yourself a saint because you think you got it now, the universe does something, pull the rug out from underneath you and show you you're barely in kindergarten. So.
Yeah, I would say, that's beautiful. I would say that, if any of us saw a mentally ill person in the street, walk just sitting there deranged, urinating on themselves, talking to themselves, we would it would be clear to all of us that person was deeply disturbed. And when you have an experience of really waking up to the absolute, your heart breaks open, and from that perspective, the life you've been living is just as disturbed as a mentally ill person sitting in their own feces would be to the average person. And if you can sit there with the heart cracked open and see this, then you actually embrace a care, and you fall to your knees, and what you realize is, I just don't want to create karma anymore. I would rather cut off my own hand than cause unnecessary suffering to another person. And then you start getting very, very serious about the cultivation of virtue. And you go to, when you have this vision at first, you think you're enlightened. And you are enlightened. And you think you don't have an ego, because what has happened is your awareness has been ripped off the relative dimension of the self into the absolute and the universal dimension, and you're looking through those eyes, and the illusion is that your ego doesn't exist anymore, because what's happened is It's resolved to a pinpoint a million miles behind you, and your entire perspective is on the glory of God, being revealed in the glory of God. And so you think you don't have an ego, but an hour or a few weeks, the first experience I had lasted 6 weeks, and I thought I was enlightened, and then all of a sudden these thoughts, these unwholesome thoughts, and the vasana, this vasana, everything started coming back. And then the stage is you start to go to war with yourself. Why am I thinking that? I thought this was gone. Why am I having this? You start to fight with ego. And you fight with ego rolling around in the sewer covered with its crap until you realize, and under the auspices of spiritual work, and so you're in the sewer rolling around, and then someone comes and goes, you might want to come out of there. You're in the sewer, and you go, can't you see that I'm working? Can't you see I'm very serious about this? And then you have an awakening one day and you realize, I'm putting all my attention on ego. Where's the glory of God? You realize the ego is just the thing that wants all the attention. And just like a child, if it's not getting positive attention, it'll throw the peas against the wall and get negative attention. It doesn't care. All it wants is to be the center of attention. That's all it wants. And you realize that even though you think you're fighting ego under the auspices of spiritual work, actually what you're doing is rolling around in a sewer, and it's getting exactly what it wants, which is just to keep you in the sewer. So then you get out of the sewer, and then you get clean, and then you can have a top-down perspective, which means you don't deny ego, but now you're going to look through ego. You're always going to look at ego through the eyes of being clean and fresh and not down there with it. So you still want to face it, and then you turn your back on it and you do spiritual cultivation. And now all the practices that you have help you maintain the fortitude, and you take a step away and a step away and a step away. And even though you get 500 miles or 500,000 miles away from the sewer is always as close as your next choice. It's always as close as the next choice that you make. And so you get cleaner and cleaner and cleaner, and the movement is from the gross to the subtle. And as I said, when I was 28, I could eat a hamburger smothered in jalapeno peppers and cheese and bacon and mushrooms. And now I sit with rice and curried vegetables, and I take a mouthful, and they're warm, and I just have so much gratitude to be receiving that. And like at dinner the other night, I had one little piece of salmon on a piece of toast, because I only eat a little bit of meat. And I just had it, and I was just very thankful for that. So there's just increasing gratitude. And what eventually happens, in my experience, is that you actually fall in love with virtue, and you feel an obligation. So faced with an ethical choice to choose for the ego or to choose for virtue, it's actually like falling in love with this friend that you're never going to see. I've heard it put this way, that you wake up to a friend you're never going to see, and you fall in love, and you actually fall in love with virtue, and then you feel an obligation to that cultivation, and the cultivation isn't for my sake. It's for my children's sake, for my wife's sake, for my patient's sake, for my student's sake. And then eventually the cultivation, you expand it as the care as large as you can, to actually wrap your head around it. But obviously the Taoists knew when they say, the universe is in me, I am in the universe and I are one, that the embrace is a cosmic care. It's a care for the cosmos itself. And the caring for the self is no longer self-motivated. In caring for myself, I am caring for the cosmos. In taking care of the biosphere, I am caring for myself and for all sentient beings and all life. And beyond the life, the process that's streaming through the entire universe that's creating that life and doing whatever it's doing, there's just one, and I am not separate from that. And the demand is absolute. And when people don't face their shadow, they give themselves to an absolute demand but don't face shadow, and then you get religious fanaticism, and it comes out as having to have all these very, very beating yourself. I read about one nun in a convent who made a garter belt of all nails pointing inward that she would wear as a practice. And you get people flagellating themselves and beating themselves. And what the postmodern person does is they either don't take spiritual practice seriously enough, and it's all just casual, one from column A, one from column B, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, or the superego takes over, that voice of the Nazi torturer, and just becomes fanatic. And if you're at an ethnocentric level of development, then everyone who believes in my creation myth is the chosen. And everyone who believes in another creation myth, they're the unclean, they're the evil other. They're the evil other. Do you see? And as we evolve beyond those early stages of cultural development, beyond nationalism, beyond ethnocentricity, then we have women's rights and gay rights and trans rights. And beyond them, we really start to wake up beyond ego to an embrace of the one, an embrace of all traditions, an embrace of just everybody waking up. And we say, how do you do this? How do you change the world? How do you change global warming? How do you change the government? And it really is true. You change yourself and you will wake up to this constant, and you cultivate virtue and you strive to be a living example of that every day a little bit more. And when you do that, that's when you discover the virtue of humility, which is the virtue associated with wood. And I read this... Archimedes Dionysus. I don't know if he's still alive. I read he was still alive. He was 93, and this was 10 years, 12 years ago, so he may not be alive. The Greek Orthodox priest, and he just said, well, you know, in the beginning, spiritual experiences, all these fireworks, but by the time you're serious, spiritual experience comes only in the form of constant humiliation. Because you're so awake to the absolute and you're so aware constantly of all the ways in which you are not that. And that creates a humility which diminishes the arrogance in the liver. And when the arrogance of the liver is diminished, then you're not taking everything personally and you have this a greater perspective and this compassion and compassion.
That's a great summary. What I would like to add is that in that process of the Tao, of our cultivation through this path of life, there are forces at work that are greater than just our ego forces, because there is a part of the esoteric Chinese sciences is this Bazi Xuan Ming, which is to use the five element system, the pillars, the eight pillars that get determined at the moment of your birth, where you've got the heavenly influence and the earthly influences of the year, of the months, of the day, and the hour that you were born. And that determines the structure of our ego that you can then measure in numbers. Okay, so that means, particularly from a five element practitioner perspective, it is good to have a non-speculative basis of how much metal is there, how much earth, what is absent, what's in excess. And you've got eight positions, one in heaven for the year, one for in heaven for the... So when you say, I'm born in the year of the ox, you're basically saying that the energy is grinding away down here and doesn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and you're having a long slugging situation before you. And you, even though the cycle moves on, the person who's born at this time will always feel like that life is this, you know, this endless tunnel of drudgery, etc. But that's only one influence. And then you've got the months, and the day is particularly important, but also the hour, and together that makes sort of the energetic imprint on your forehead. But what it is, it's not a deterministic view of who you are, it's a determination of the structure of your ego that makes you predictable. So what is it that you get addicted to? Are you going to be, you know, like a sex chaser or a drug addict or a workaholic or power hungry that makes that up? And then what happens is you have this science of where you can determine in this period of your life, as long as you're not cultivated enough so that your ego is still so strong that'll become predictable, you can literally predict somebody's future and their past. And I've met some people in China. It was completely eerie because they were so good that this 27-year-old kid, who, by the way, himself, you know, Lonnie always talks about that, just that somebody's really good at that, whether it's meditation or qigong or moving objects or, you know, telling you your not just what happened before in your life, and the people just one after another burst into tears because he got their number so directly and said, oh, you know, you always, like, men always take advantage of you, and by the way, when you go home, your boyfriend's already moved on, and all of that was true in this one trip. But that the miasmic streams of the ego predictability in your whole tribe is somehow in there as well. So one of the things was, 7 years ago, your uncle had an affair with his driver or something like that. It was like that even something, or with the secretary, even that was true. However, those kinds of people will admit and say, if you're a monk, I can't, there's nothing I can do. Because see what happens is you've got this deterministic, like your ego is like this, and you always look at it like Lonnie was saying, you're having this kind of earth lens or whatever it is here, you're looking at it and it determines you, and then you're moving into a different space which you can energetically, qualitatively measure, and then you put the two of them together, and then becomes, if your fire is already in excess and you hit a fire year and a fire month, and then of course all kinds of fire sins are going to erupt during that time, and fire organs are going to become inflamed, etc. But so sometimes you think you're working particularly hard, and then the disappointment comes. Why is the rug being pulled out underneath? Fuck this, I'm not going to do it again because I just don't understand what happened. I really tried harder and it's happened even worse now. But that's just simply because these forces are working, and sometimes the wind is in your sail, and you think you did it, but it's actually the universe helping you. Like in my case, this guy said, this was in 2002, and I said, I had this myocarditis 2 years ago, and I'm taking herbs, I'm feeling better, but my heart is, I don't have cardiomyopathy, but I have this irregular heartbeat, and how long is this going to go on? And he said, this is going to take until 2004. And so it was like 2004, and first month, second month, I'm like, is it going to have this forever? And then in November, from one day to another, boom, all of a sudden the heart was back in rhythm. So these things are, you know, all this time I've been taking herbs every single day, but it had to wait until this time when the wind of the universe was in my sail, and then it could happen. So on the positive side, sometimes all kinds of luck comes our way, and it wasn't our doing. And sometimes all kinds of shit comes our way, and despite our efforts, the rug is still being pulled out, and it's because of these things. But at a certain level, these external winds, you know, there's a famous story of Su Dongpo, the greatest poet of his time, who was also a Buddhist practitioner in the 11th century in the Song Dynasty, and he had a Zen master who was lived in a monastery on the other side of the river, and he sat in meditation, felt inspired, and wrote this poem that said something like, the lotus is blooming around me, the butterflies, you know, swing their wings, and I sit in meditation, and Ba feng chui bu dong, the eight winds of the world do not touch me, you know, which is sort of meaning, no, and no matter what comes in front of me, people die, I'm like Zhuangzi and beating the drum and celebrate life. And then he's all proud and sends a servant over to the master, and the master takes a brush and crosses it out and writes on it, fang pi, fart, fart, bullshit. And brings it back, and the great Su Dongpo is like completely flabbergasted and goes like, oh my God, you know, it's like he rushes across the river, comes to the gate, the gatekeeper in the monastery says the master is in meditation, you can't go in there and see him. He says, you don't know who I am, I'm the magistrate of the district, I'm his best friend, and I need to go in there. No, you can't go in there, he specifically said, you can't come in. He rushes in, there's a seal on the inner door, he breaks open the seal and says, Master, what's going on? It's maybe I'm not enlightened yet, but surely this is still a great piece of poetry and a reflection of where I am. And he said, Ba feng chui bu dung, the eight winds don't move you, a single fart blew you across the river. So there is this kind of, sometimes we just think we hear, and then, so that's life. You know?
That's fantastic. So, that's really good. That's like the story of me in clinic, seeing people. There are these ironies. In other words, people are presenting, the presenting face to the world is one thing, but while they're speaking, if you have the skill, you just are seeing through it the entire time, the facade. So the person, this person in the story has a self-image and writes this beautiful poem from the self-image about who he thinks he is, but the master just does a little thing and can just, it's a straw dog, and he can see through the ego in a second. One of the things that struck me when Heiner was speaking, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it struck me that obviously he and I are constitutionally different. And
really?
Well, that's why I think we love each other's work and why we're attracted to the possibility of doing this. And it struck me while he was talking, you know, practically, my entire emphasis is on just how you free yourself from exterior constraint. In other words, the role of will, the capacity to wake up, the capacity to turn the wheel around, the capacity to be free of all the external forces. And I'm realizing that what Heiner's been significantly talking about is the confirmations outside of us that have all these influences that are unseen. And it just makes me, on the one hand, it makes me want to like get his books and really, really learn this stuff, because it struck me, it's so interesting to me that I thought it would be an interesting format to teach this class, to have Heiner over there go around like the lower left quadrant of the circle, and then to have me go around the lower left quadrant, in other words, to start at water. And then to have Heiner get up here and for me to go to wood and fire and to go around the circle 1-1-1-1, because we think about things in just completely different ways, and yet there's overlap. And so when I was listening to him, that's all very interesting, and I think we're presenting it from just a different perspective. I tend to see the potential and then all the conditioning and how to see through the conditioning and just liberate that impulse. But Heiner is not just, he understands conditioning, but he's not just seeing conditioning, but everything that's favorable there as well, configuring. So, I mean, that was just an interesting distinction to me.
But in the end, the goal is the same. You want to free yourself. That's the goal of cultivation, that wheel of rebirth in Buddhism is how do you escape, how do you get to this paradise, these winds come at you, but you don't react. It's not like that you can't feel them, and you're aware of that something is tugging, but you're not reacting to it, because if you do, that's what makes a mess out of life. And that's that again, that very, to me, significant sentence. Sometimes it is, you know, you see something, you contemplate, and then you just have one sentence and it's clear like this. You know, what's the difference between the great Yao, Confucian sages Yao and Shun, and the great Yu and these evil demon emperors? They're the same. They have the same winds tugging at them. They have the same temptations. But these people act upon those impulses and those people don't. And that's, in a certain way, that's what it's all about, that enlightenment is not to be in some blissed out stage where the ego finally says, oh, I feel good. It's like, and it never lets up. It's that you are truly have that freedom to choose your destiny, and you go like, oh, this is, there is some part of me. It's just awareness. You're aware rather than acting upon impulse and then going like, I need to take a walk right now because my heart feels like that. Well, that might be a heart, but that's hexagram 43, not hexagram 44. So you're talking about this heart, not this heart.
Right. And in choosing destiny, the mistake that many people make is, I'll know what my destiny, the choice for destiny is going to feel good. So the whole New Age myth is, if I'm aligned with spirit, the pyramid scheme that I'm involved with, I'll wind up at the top. If I'm aligned with spirit, the money will flow, the sex will flow, my children will get into good schools. Nonsense. Nonsense. And, you know, the myth of Christ stands as an example, at least in Western culture, but all cultures have these myths. And it's just simple enough to say sometimes the right thing, there's nothing in it for you. Sometimes the right choice, the choice of this demand Kelly's asking about, this increasing demand, at some point you realize there's nothing in this for me. And by for me, I mean the ego. The ego gets on the spiritual path because it wants relief from itself. Do you understand? And then at some, the ego wants relief from its own crazy self. And then at some point, as you begin to wake up, the ego recoils because it realizes that the liberation of the spirit has nothing to do with making it feel good. The liberation of the spirit is actually its own annihilation, its own death. And it is access to all your thoughts, all your feelings, all your emotions, all your fears, all your memories. And then you get to a point where you've been a seeker for all these years, and the next step is to being a finder. But to be a finder, you're stepping beyond the very thing, the mind, that has all these ideas about what enlightenment means and about what it means to be free. And being free might mean you're in a jail cell for 28 years, and your captors are telling you all you have to do is sign a piece of paper saying you won't work to bring down apartheid and you can go free. And for 28 years, your choice every day is to remain in that cell because even in a jail cell 10 by 10 feet, you can be the living embodiment of human freedom that brings down apartheid. You're no less effective in that jail cell than you would be if you were outside, you see? You're actually, there's the Chinese term xiao, meaning small, like xiao hai, heart three, little c. And when Claude Lara would talk about this, he would say, well, xiao is not insignificant. Xiao is the amount of energy there is if you just split an atom. An atom is very small, but you split it and then you have this power. So with Nelson Mandela in this jail cell, you could say, well, he's constrained, but he chooses a position of freedom and does practice and condenses. And then all of that is in this smaller place, and there's so much potential that can be released. So to make a comment, about 15 people have said to me this week, and boy, you're really hard. The schedule's really hard. Do we have to meditate? Someone came up this morning and said, you should change the name of this to Chinese medicine boot camp. I'm like, boot camp? You slept until 7. You did Qigong for a little while, shaking up and down. You had a fantastic breakfast. You had to attend a Chinese medicine lecture. You got served, you're being served farm fresh vegetables here.
But the espresso machine didn't work properly.
I told her to unplug it, knowing Heiner was coming. I said, even Heiner is going to have to stretch a little.
That's right. That's really tough.
And so then Kelly came up to me and she said, Lonnie, I saw a side of you last night I had no idea existed. And everyone came up, thank you so much. That was such welcome relief
from having to. you think you had all been, you know, dropped behind enemy lines with a 22 pistol with one round in it and a bar of chocolate and one sip in a canteen. And so she said this. And the point to me is that, look, when you take the serious, when you take the things that one should be deadly serious about deadly seriously, and then you're serious about the things you should be serious about, and you're casual about the things you should actually be casual about, you can put yourself into, when you dance, you dance. When you play music, you rock out. And when you meditate, you die. And when you go to sleep at night after a full day's work, you surrender into infinite deep sleep. And when you get up in the morning, you get out of bed and you do your practice and you go and greet the day. And then you're really, really alive. And to me, this is very Confucian. The idea of having being disciplined in the right way and having what might look to a postmodern person like this rigorous discipline. And do I really have to sit up straight? And well, do you know that there were people walking out of meditation 45 seconds before the bell went off? People were getting up and leaving, and a miracle, and I don't understand this, but if you tell me meditate for an hour and 20 minutes, when I open my eyes, the second hand will be coming like this. I can do it for 3 hours, I can do it for an hour, I can do it for half an hour, I can do it for 15 minutes. The only time I can't do it is if I'm 7-8 days in, and you tell me to meditate for an hour, I'll sit there for 4. Because by then there's no time and I have no facility for this. But anyway, people were calling it quits and leaving 1 minute and 10 seconds. One person left once 45 seconds before the bell went off. I heard someone put their pillow away and walk out, and I felt like, it's got to be an hour, and I looked, and it was like 27 seconds. And the thing is, the ego is always going to get up 1 second before. That's the turtle refusing to take its finger off the shell. So the thing is, so to me, it's like this was a very casual, very easy. If Heiner had said to me, you know, you should do this just like the, you know, really do it the way Lonnie Jarrett wants to do it, you'd have been up 4 o'clock in the morning and we'd have gone to 11 o'clock at night. And there would have been 2 3-hour teachings a day, and then every hour in between would have been an hour of meditation, an hour of Qigong, an hour of meditation, an hour of chanting, an hour of meditation, an hour of Qigong. Is on here? There she is. So I designed a retreat for An, 30 days retreat, and I had her going from 6 in the morning till 10 at night, and I made it getting harder and harder and harder, and she looked at it and got to the last week and just did the whole last week for the entire month. So it was like 1 month, 5 to 11 or something? 6 to? 5 to 11. 1 hour, and I had her up to 3 hours of straight meditation, no moving. 1 hour, 2 hours of chanting. I was very kind, and I left her an hour for physical practice every day. And she did it no problem. And you can see how free she is, right? Not absolutely free. Lots of crazy French-Canadian stuff in there. But anyway, the thing is, to me, it's just this Confucian ideal relative to virtue. You're deadly serious about the deadly serious things, and that creates a context for real joy and real gratitude. So then, you know, when the band's playing, you can go for it with total heart, and you just want to create beauty for people, bring people together. And I just say this, the postmodern person, the great gift of the postmodern person is this radical sensitivity. Most of your grandparents didn't have it. It's a new attribute in humanity. Can you imagine being in the boats going toward Omaha Beach with the Nazi machine gunners up there? And can you imagine being in the boats and all of the group leaders in the boat saying, we're going to land on the beach in 5 minutes?
But now I'd like to make a circle and I'd like everybody to share how they're feeling. The boats would still be out there and Hitler would be ruling Europe from Austria in the eagle's nest, right? Do you understand? They'd still be out. You know, I just really don't want to go onto the beach. I'm just feeling very sensitive about this. So can you imagine what the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan? It'd be 15 guys in a boat going like this for the first few, which would have been more painful than actually watching the slaughter. Because at least there was some dignity in that. Yeah?
I totally agree that we need to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, and essentially my way of phrasing is to wood up, and to see that part of us that wants to take the stomach heart way, thinking of listening to our heart. I find for myself, and when I'm working with patients, that there's a moment when I see myself having stepped off the wheel and in the sewer, where if I sit with loving kindness and embracing with a more feminine manner that, and with humor, like, oh my God, look at how funny I am that I'm so human that I just fell back in the sewer again, that I find that compassion for myself and seeing the radiance of my own being when with my patients in that moment really helps me and them get back on the wheel again to say, yes, I want to listen to my heart and I want to stay on that path because it is the only way to be.
That sounds good. That's what I thought I was doing the other night that she was asking me about. Remember when I laughed and said, wow, that's kind of, that could be really arrogant. So I was seeing something about myself and kind of laughing and giving it space.
And I love that moment.
Yeah. Well, I think everything you said sounds good to me.
That's all I wanted to say.
I would just make a distinction about whether it's more feminine. I mean, because I do it. So in human development, as you begin to transcend ego, the masculine and feminine become integrated. Right? So we can have these archetypes about masculine and feminine. Those archetypes of masculine and feminine, a lot of what's in there when I make comments has to do with lower levels of development where they're radically divided due to survival conditions, early stage of development, the first few chakras. But as any human being becomes integrated and starts to step beyond ego, then you're stepping into the universal, which is the dimension of who we are beyond duality. And then these capacities become integrated, which doesn't mean that men all become like David Bowie and, right, and women all become like Laurie Anderson or something. I don't know if she's the female equivalent of David Bowie, but they both have spiky hair, so there's... But you understand, so it's not so, men might even become more masculine,
absolutely,
but there's an open heart and a warm, because they're embracing this warm embrace, so the masculinity is less of a caricature and compensation and more of an authentic presentation, and women may become more naturally all those qualities we'd associate with yin, but they're not habitual, they're not manipulative.
Maybe
they're no longer manipulative.
To, in those moments, to use my heart and the earth within me to then use my wood.
However you think about it, all that matters to me is the compassion and the perspective you brought, however we think about it. But I totally agree.
In the Chinese mythology, the human being, just like God in the Old Testament, formed the human being from a clod of earth and that holy mountain in Jerusalem. It's the goddess Nuwa that you always see together with Fuxi, who, by the way, she also is associated with the triple warmer. And is the master of this Xirangtu, that Lani talked about, that the clod of earth that the father of the great Yu Gun took the dam in. She took this kind of earth to form, fashion the human being. And so that has meaning we have unlimited creativity and the potential for these virtues in us, but we also, the ego, if you analyze it from a Chinese medicine perspective, is the earth has a good component in it. And as a result of it, there's always this, what Lani just mentioned, is this question, what's in it for me? And the trick is really to come to this place that Lani just outlined, which is you doing it because you trust the tradition and you're willing to surrender that, where you go like, I'm going to get something at the end. It's sour and bitter right now, but later I'll get something for it. And I experienced that in the most, because I spent so much time in China looking for the perfect teachers, and they all, if you're going to these retreats with guys with long hair and golden robes, and I did that quite literally, and the beginning cancer victim going there was all emaciated and lack of vitality, and I went to some of those retreats and I was like, I gained like 10 pounds in 2 days and felt like much stronger. But then you discover all kinds of problems and with that, and I must say, like, the closest teacher I have in China is Master Wang, who is the lineage-holder of the Jinjingong we're practicing, and the practice has saved my life in a certain way that makes me physically feel stronger. But Dr. Wang himself, historical reasons, other reasons, he very often gets physically sick. Whereas the one person I've seen out of all of these Qigong teachers and herbal teachers or so, who never gets sick, not for the last 50 years, is this Liu Shanren, Liu Yosheng is his name, was just this this almost illiterate peasant who's one of the students of one of Wang Fenghi's female students, and who was on his deathbed in his 20s with liver cancer and diabetes and kidney failure and having like 5 different life-threatening diseases altogether. Somebody gave him these books. He read them. He started vomiting for 2 weeks, all of this bile and black and green. And then he started cultivating and he wanted to teach that in sort of a messianic type of way. And his teacher let him wait for 25 years and said, you can't just go out there, teach people on what to do when you yourself is not. And once again, when I went to his house for 25 years that he's now been teaching, I think of myself, it's got lots of problems, but there is that image a little bit like Sudumbo. I'm trying to do good in the world and healing people, and once in a while I treat some people for free, etc. So there is sort of an image there, but that was completely obliterated the minute I went to this guy's house, who, it's like a space that is like a quarter of this room. His whole family lives there, and literally people are, just vomiting all over the place, and they're eating his food, and everybody in the household is just serving this enterprise. And it's just that part of myself that, in a certain way, the anthropologist, the Marco Polo complex person, I was like, wow, yeah, I'm the first Westerner observing it, and, make sure my cameraman will make sure it gets into the can. But my ego, all three of us, we were on the train to Harbin, we were speechless. We were just like, so happy to be out of there. And at the same time, we were so stunned that we wanted to run away from this as fast as we can. He doesn't do any Qigong. He doesn't do any of this stuff. He doesn't do anything. Oh, I do this for you. You give me this then later, or you build me a hospital. the guy never gets sick, and he is truly happy. You know, it's like that's what he loves to do. You know, that's sort of an example. You don't care what, you know, for something in return, there is lots of unexpected return that might look different from how we envision it, but it'll be better in the end, even from just a medical perspective.
AJ?
Do you still have your... You had your hand up for a while, Eliza? Or okay.
Well, we get you next, Eliza. I didn't see her.
I think you're both touching on some things that I see a lot, especially since I've been studying with you, Mike. How do we, as postmodern people, see through how many expectations we have of perfection in teachers? To see, you know, there are so many light people in the world.
Just have enough teachers. Well, no, that's not a postmodern No, you're not putting the... Can I answer? So you're not putting this right. So we have pre-modern, modern, and postmodern. In psychological terms, more or less in terms of stages, pre-conventional, conventional, post-conventional, in terms of human development. So pre-modern would be all the traditions. The mythic traditions are all pre-modern. Modern would be scientific rationalism. Modernism brought lots of great things like wireless microphones and iPads and central heating. And modernism, we can say, began with René Descartes saying, I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I am, moving the locus of self from heart to head. And putting cognitive thought and rationalism first, which was radical at the time because it helped differentiate humanity from the dominance of the myth and superstition and the hierarchies built upon myth and superstition. So the hierarchies were based on gender, race, creation myth, family name, family lineage. These were dominator hierarchies. And 99% of the human race was destitute in the street, and their destiny was to die by the time they were 32. And you had the, you know, 1% or 0.1% in the royal family, and all of us have better lives than they. Everyone in this room has more options than the Emperor of China ever had. He couldn't say, you want to go for Northern Indian or Southern Indian tonight? Which of the 50 sushi bars would you like? Do you want to go to the Mongolian restaurant? What could the Pharaoh do? The Pharaoh on a good day got grapes. Yeah. What do you want to do today, dear? Let's watch the slaves build the pyramids. It must have been fantastic. So we know the upside of modernism, central heating and automobiles, and scientific rationalism got rid of witch trials. And that's all fantastic. And but the downside was that the Nazis, who were at a tribalist, ethnocentric level, got a hold of technology that only modern people could build, like tanks and trains and machine guns and airplanes. It's not modernism that did that. If you had gone to Genghis Khan and showed him an AK-47, he would have been all about it, baby. So what happened is that modernism brought in a technology that people at an ethnocentric tribal level were like leaving a loaded gun in the house with your baby, with your child. So in the wake of overthrowing the Nazis and getting rid of the Roman Catholic Church and throwing it out of Europe, right, throwing the church out of Europe and beating the Nazis, Postmodernism came in, and the capacity of postmodernism is this new capacity that emerges, which is to hold many perspectives at once. Now you would say, well, didn't the Taoists hold many perspectives at once? Well, they had never met a Polish person. They had never met someone from Chicago. They had never met anyone from North America. It's still geographic isolation. So now all rivers of culture are flowing together into one ocean as we're in a global central world. The high capacity of postmodernism is in the face of Nazism and the Catholic Church to be able to say all human beings, regardless of race, gender, gender identification, ethnicity, regardless of which creation myth they believe in, all human beings have an innate right to lead a life of dignity free from fear. And our capacity of postmodern people is pluralism, which is the capacity to hold many points of view at the same time, right? To hold many points. But in that, that became conflated with relativism, where all points of view are equal. So it's actually when you say, as postmodern people, we expect teachers to be perfect, no. No. If you expect a teacher to be perfect, you're embracing the pre-modern myth of the teacher as the human embodiment of the absolute. You have an expectation of a teacher to be like the mythic Buddha or Christ. If you're going to look through postmodern eyes, you have your truth, I have my truth, nobody knows the truth. All of the hippies who studied, what did Trungpa do? Trungpa said, screw everybody. What did Rajneesh do? I worked in clinic 32 years ago when I was in school. This young boy came in who was 23 who had been in Rajneesh's ashram. And this kid was so screwed up because Rajneesh had let him pick out 5 women and those were his wives. At 23, and this kid just had no sense of reality after being in an experience like that. You're in terms of just having a shen blown out and total ego inflation, total narcissism just inflated. So when you talk about the expectations of teachers being perfect, that is purely a mythic formulation. That is a pre-modern formulation. The modern formulation is just scientific rationalism. And the postmodern formulation would be just you have your truth, I have my truth. Nobody knows. The postmodern person is the person who's sitting in the audience here thinking, yeah, that's what Fruhoff thinks. I'll be taking my NCCAOM exam in a few months, and I've had a few classes. That's what Jared thinks. Do you get that as you travel? When you teach, there's kids are in school, and they're just starting, and their truth is as good as your truth. They're in clinic, and you're the supervisor, and they say, I want to do this, and you say, my truth is as real. Who are you to judge me? Right? The person is burning up, they have a 400-degree fever, and the tongue is bright red with a solid black coating on it. Let's give them futsa, ginger, and cinnamon twig. Okay. And you go, no, maybe, oh, I understand where you're coming from, but maybe we could try this. And they're like, God, he's so judgmental. See, so that's the postmodern view. So this is a lesson hard learned. And I think this goes, is it Barbara? This goes back to what Barbara said. Look, we have to, on the one hand, be deadly serious about the deadly serious things, and on the other hand, when we're deadly serious about the deadly serious things, seeking will come to an end. But when seeking comes to an end, humility begins. And then in that humility, we can develop the compassion. But compassion to me, so I sat with this fellow, Genpo Merzel, who does Big Mind, the Big Mind teaching, which is a good teaching. It's a radical teaching. Convey a lot of enlightenment quick. But I sat with him in a room with my teacher and him and about 10 students, and he gave a talk for 2 hours, and then we talked to him, and his talk was about hierarchy and spiritual traditions. And he let us know that he only teaches 5 spiritual retreats a year, and they're called 5-5-5. 5 people, 5 days, $50,000 apiece. A Okay? So the man's making $1 million a year. This is apparently what he feels he needs to live. From teaching 4 retreats to 5 people. And he was telling us how people would take out second mortgages on their home to be able to do it. And he'd say, and then I sit in my white clothes and I sit in my robes and I sit there and I assume this mythic posture. Okay, and it occurred to me in listening to him that he didn't know the first goddamn thing about hierarchy relative to spiritual teaching. It was interesting to me. He's the highest ranked Zen monk in the West. He's the highest ranked white person who's a Zen monk, a lineage holder in the West, and he didn't know the first thing, and I think this is interesting, a monk in a Japanese tradition who knows nothing about hierarchy. And 2 months later, it comes out, he's been like screwing one of his students. He's married, he gives up, he puts down the robes, says, I renounce the robes, renounce the teaching, and the excuse he gives for doing this is I had to work out unresolved issues with my mother. Too much information, thank you very much. So it's interesting to me that a Buddhist gives a Western psychological explanation as an excuse for why he had to do what he did. Where's all the wisdom? Where's the accumulated wisdom? He had no relationship to hierarchy. When the postmodern person, the gift of postmodernism is being able to deconstruct all reality. The sin of it is it makes everything equal, because it can deconstruct everything, it makes everything equal and there's no hierarchy. And then you find out that people who say you shouldn't judge and completely reject hierarchy out there in culture, the flip side of that is they refuse to make the distinctions it takes within the self in order to make clear choices, because there are so many voices and so many motivations within us. And when hierarchy is rejected externally, then there's no, that's a reflection, a shadow projection of a failure inside to make the moral distinctions it takes to cultivate the kind of virtues. Because cultivating virtue has nothing to do with feeling good internally. It has, cultivating virtue only exists to the degree it's actually manifest in your behavior. And your behavior is based on choice, and your every choice reflects your values. And there's a hierarchy. The first chakra has its values. The second chakra has its values. The third chakra has its values. The direction of moral development is higher and higher, and every chakra has an increasing embrace as other, as self. And what the postmodern person wants to do is say, well, now I'm on retreat, and I'm wearing my robes, and I'm going to sit still, and I'm embracing these very high values, and that's who I am. But now nobody's looking, and my first chakra gets a say, and nobody can judge me. And when you get serious about cultivating, at some point you fall in love with virtues, and when the creative impulse is really liberated, you're at least 51%. So this idea of being perfect is you're 100%. But 51% is all the momentum you need to get the wheel spinning in the other direction, and that's enough. Once the wheel is spinning in the other direction, then you're self-authoring your life. Who you are in any moment is predominantly a reflection of the virtue you're striving toward, and the past is only, at best, 49% of an influence. But the better future you're trying to create is 51% of an influence. And I'll make one more point. I think the mythic guru is dead. I'll tell you this, if you have a spiritual teacher and you're framing them in the context of the mythic guru, which is that they're perfect and they're the living embodiment of the absolute, you are setting yourself up for great pain. And when that pain comes, remember my words and realize that you have a choice between waking up more or becoming cynical. And what many people do is they leave the church and then they have no spirituality. Instead, what you do is you take it on you. And the last thought I'll leave right here for just what I'm saying now is I'm quite convinced that at our level of development, The guru is whatever was emerging in that room during those conversations. And it's not an individual. It's a collective emergence from the collective. It's a greater intelligence. It's something that, and it's not pre-existing. Everyone was saying, it's always there, it's always there. It's not, it's always there and I can just tap into it whenever I want. It's a creative endeavor. And it takes a certain sacrifice on the part of the each person. Because could you notice when people would start speaking really abstractly what the effect was on the emergence? There's something, the abstraction lives in the mind, and when the Taoists say Ziran, we all have this dimension of life. I have it when I'm teaching. So where I find myself most, where Lani really exists most is when I'm teaching, and when I'm in that collective or with my students or with people who understand and we're sharing that context. And then I find myself most as an emergence between all of us. But everyone else there would say that we're all finding that same oneself. And I really do think that's the teacher now, and that the mythic guru is dead. And that as postmodern people, we had no example of this. And the Eastern teaching went over, and we had been with Descartes since 1650, and everything was so linear and materialistic. So we saw this simplicity before complexity in the teachings of the Han Dynasty and the prior teachings and the teachings of the Taoists. And these beautiful teachings, we saw them, this early childhood simplicity. The great texts, I always say, were not the last word, they were the first word. And we've gone through this complexity of the emergence of the ego, and all this modern complexity where we're destroying the biosphere, and we have these cities now, not just with 5,000 people living in them, or during the Han Dynasty, it might have been 30 or 50,000 people, big, big. Now we have 7-10 million people living in cities. We have this great complexity. And I think as we step beyond ego, we have the eyes to see through it and deconstruct it, but also the courage to start putting hierarchy back in without being so worried about Nazism. At our level of development, we do not rape. We do not murder out of negative emotions at our level of development. We don't do that. That doesn't mean we're completely enlightened and there isn't eons to go, but there is a certain level of culture on the planet, which is just probably 5% of the planet, where we actually, isn't there a demographic in Israel that if they had all the power, and isn't there a demographic in Palestine, if they had all the power, the two could meet and settle the conflict? Aren't there people at a certain level of development who could do this? Right? They could put the past in the past. Aren't there Palestinians and Israelis who embrace as brother and sister? Yes, there are. And are they wearing suicide vests and killing each other? Not those people. Not those people. So there is a leading edge. There is a demographic. And anyway, so Hunter,
I would say on that note, if he's going to take a break, we should probably do that now.
Okay.
And so should we do that now? And I recommend that. And then we were planning to do these five virtue chants for 20 minutes or so after the break in like 5-7 minutes or so.
Sandy?
And then we'll continue. Oh, four remedies we didn't put up: bamboo, oxbone, love, and ginkgo.
Oxbone, love.
Yes. So the bamboo and the oxbone I would put in the taiyang bladder. Oxbone, by the way, designed for trauma to the bone. So that's but actually it's used a lot for osteoporosis. It helps you to remineralize the bone. Think of it as a bone broth and a capsule with blood movers in it. And bamboo, of course, for body pain, whether it's arthritis or Lyme caused. And then with Guizhi Shaoyao Jimutang, love pearls is another that probably I would put to the kidney pericardium position, which is 60% goat testicles and some epimedium and other kind of weizi, those kinds of herbs in there. But it's, again, a food-based kind of supplement that was originally used for erectile dysfunction in males, but I prescribe more to women. You know, I think that's, you know, anything low testosterone count, you can consider that. And yeah, ginkgo is a durian, so that goes into the stomach and the liver, particularly good for headache and severe nausea and other kinds of counterflow issues, including brain cancer and bad headaches in Lyme and addiction. And then, what was the last one? That's it, yes. Okay. Bamboo bladder together with the, but you want to think joints and connective tissue, fibromyalgia, arthritis, body pain and Lyme. Bamboo oxbone is any time you injure yourself, you want to use oxbone heavily. But then you want to, after 6 weeks, when it's like the weather changes and still aches, then you have arthritic, autoimmune kinds of things, so you need to add the bamboo in. So then I usually, but usually oxbone will bring down injury recovery to at least half. Like you can take the cast off in half of the time. And it's also a great remedy to get rid of soreness after exercise. So if you run a marathon, you feel like paralyzed for 4 days afterwards, you take that in large amounts, as my son who likes to run marathons tells me, and it's just the next day you feel, oh, I don't feel anything. So it's quite a difficult to make a Taoist remedy that was... I received from the Jinjing Gong, Dr. Wang teachings. He's asked me about that. So far, I've politely said I will do that. But I need to... The problem is that an important component in Yunnan Baiyao is Sanxi, Noto Ginseng, and almost all of the supply is polluted with incredible amounts of pesticides because it's a cash crop and everybody wants it, and it takes 3 years. But there, I found a good replacement that grows in the wild. It's Panax japonicus, the baisanxi, the white sanxi, and I just ordered a batch and I want to try it first. But if that works, then we can produce that. Yeah.